This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We believe this investigation should be quite wide-ranging because he was denied access to adequate medical care during the 6 years he was in custody.
That's Rupert Colville, spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, on the UN's call for an investigation into former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi's death. Details coming up. Also, Sudan protest groups plan night marches in an attempt to pressure the military for a return to civilian rule. And officials in Ethiopia have yet to explain the latest mobile internet service outage in the country that lasted for about 40 hours. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Human Rights Office is calling for a prompt, impartial, transparent investigation into the sudden death Monday of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi in a Cairo court where he was on trial on espionage charges. Egypt has accused the UN of trying to politicize Morsi's death. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president, collapsed after completing a statement in court. Spokesman for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Rupert Colville, says the exact cause of Morsi's death is not wholly clear. But international humanitarian law, he says, clearly states any sudden death in custody must be followed by a thorough, independent investigation to clarify the cause of death. At the same time, he tells VOA the state, which was responsible for Morsi's well-being, should not carry out an investigation.
In the case of Mr. Morsi, we believe this investigation should be quite wide-ranging because he was denied access to adequate medical care during the 6 years he was in custody. He also didn't have proper access to lawyers and his family, which he has a right to as a prisoner.
Colville says an investigation should encompass all those aspects to see if conditions of his detention had an impact on his death. Egyptian authorities say Morsi died of a heart attack. He was buried on Tuesday, a day after he died. His family was allowed to be present at his funeral, but reportedly was not given access to an autopsy report. Colville says he is not entirely sure whether or not an autopsy was carried out.
Certainly the burial seems to have been very hasty. Of course, if there hasn't been an autopsy, that would make a proper investigation into the cause of his death, whether there are any factors related to his treatment when he was being detained, very hard to ascertain. So that would be hugely problematic if there wasn't an autopsy.
Morsi, who was ousted by a military coup 1 year after taking office, reportedly suffered from diabetes and had problems with his liver and kidneys. Colville says it is the state's responsibility to ensure that he and other prisoners in custody be treated humanely. He says it seems Morsi may have been deprived of the health care he needed for his serious ailments. He says that could have been a factor in his death and is something that needs to be investigated. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A Kenyan court has convicted three men for helping Somali jihadists carry out an attack on Garissa University, in which 148 people were killed. Phone records and handwriting linked them to the 2015 attack by four Al-Shabaab group members from Somalia who were killed. Their attorney said he will appeal. Sentencing is scheduled for July 3rd. A fourth defendant was acquitted. Ethnic Dogon villages in central Mali have come under attack for the second time this month, with at least 38 people killed and many others injured. The attacks occurred Monday near the border with Burkina Faso. A Malian intelligence officer told the Associated Press that survivors identified the perpetrators as ethnic Piyul acting in retaliation for a massacre in a Peul village in March that left nearly 160 people dead. The government has been struggling with violence in the north since 2012, sparked by radical Islamist and Tuareg militias, and ethnic clashes in the center of the country have spiked since a predominantly Fulani jihadist group emerged in 2015. Mali's military says an army patrol suffered unspecified human and material losses in an ambush yesterday at Gosi in the north. A conference on eradicating female genital mutilation, FGM, and child marriage was geared to help translate the commitment of governments, religious leaders, traditional leaders, and other stakeholders to end the practices in Africa. Reporter Panderambai has the story.
The United Nations says at least 200 million women and young girls have been exposed to female genital mutilation, or FGM, with 650 million exposed to early marriage. That is why anti-FGM campaigners have decided to come up with a challenge to end FGM and child marriage by the year 2030. Fumsil Malmonuka is the executive director of Women at the United Nations.
It's wonderful that in Africa now we have the space and the time to be here to listen to young people who want to see action, who want to collaborate with us so that together we can change our continent.
The two-day Dakar conference is the first of its kind to bring together anti-FGM and early marriage activists within and outside the continent. It was organized by the governments of Senegal and the Gambia in partnership with other non-governmental organizations. Among the delegates to the conference was Aya Chibi, the African Union Youth Envoy.
This is a start of a Pan-African movement to end FGM, child marriage, and all harmful practices in Africa. This is an Africa-led, female-led, a survivor-led movement. We are in Dakar with more than 500 people from 20 countries, and from here we start. We start from here as young and elders, ruler, urban, grassroots, global, religious leaders and governments, with the support of allies and partners.
Chibi knows that the challenge facing the anti-FGM and child marriage campaigners in the next decade requires what she calls transnational Pan-African solidarity. She also says they need a strong organized movement to forge ahead in combating the harmful traditional practices. The Gambian-born UN Regional Goodwill Ambassador, Jahar Dukure, wept when she addressed the conference. She is a victim of FGM.
They bring solutions into our communities and tell us what to do and how to do it. And for the first time, we came together and did something.
Supporters of FGM and child marriage often invoke cultural norms and values to justify the practices. FGM was outlawed in the Gambia during Dictator Jammeh's rule. The conference also heard from some women who detailed the cruel details of undergoing the practice.
I remember laying on the surgical table and my mom watching me, and that was when I really realized that I was going to be mutilated.
She started cutting. I was crying.
It was agony painful. In fact, I can't explain about the pain, but the pain is too much.
I'm now in my 30s and I can still remember that day like it was yesterday.
Delegates have called for the right of the child to be respected. They also said girls should not be exposed to marriage unless they reach the age of 18. For VOA Africa, this is Panderambai reporting.
When dozens of people died in ethnic clashes last month on the outskirts of Addis Ababa, protesters took to the streets. The Ethiopian government turned off the internet. Mobile internet service stayed off for about 40 hours. It was the second time this year the internet has gone down in Ethiopia during times of unrest. A months-long outage began last year during protests that led to the resignation of Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn. Officials have yet to explain this latest outage, but activists and journalists believe the typical justification to ensure public safety in turbulent times does not hold up to scrutiny. They are also concerned that the government continues to suppress information and impede journalists, even in the midst of wide-reaching reforms. The country has one of the lowest internet penetration rates in the world, but many more people have at least limited access through mobile devices. 15 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Wounded French-speaking troops and their family members are asking the government of Cameroon to negotiate a peaceful end to the separatist war in its English-speaking regions. The soldiers who have been flown to hospitals in Yaoundé and Douala say within the past 2 months, many of their peers have been dying because the fighters have acquired modern weapons and have a mastery of the environment. Moki Edwin Kenzaka visited the wounded troops in hospitals and families that have lost members, and he reports from Yaoundé.
It is an inconsolable 62-year-old Elizabeth Etimo, mother of Eric Etimo, a 27-year-old police officer who was killed Monday by separatist fighters in the English-speaking southwestern town of Mamfe. Dozens of family members and well-wishers have been visiting their Emombo Yaoundé residence to console the widow. Eric's uncle, 50-year-old military man Bruno Azege, acts as spokesperson for the family. Just returned from Mamfe, says God saved him from the devastating war that killed 4 of the 9 troops with whom he fought against the separatists for 3 months.
Juste un souhait que ce qui se vit dans notre pays cesse, que nos frères.
He says his wish and prayer is for the government to immediately negotiate an end to the war so that the disgruntled English-speaking brothers who have taken arms and are not ready to lay them down until their grievances are attended to, return home and stop the loss of too many lives. He says the war has affected so many French-speaking Cameroonians, either by killing, wounding, and incapacitating their loved ones or ruining their economies. Currently, at the Yaoundé military and police hospitals, there are 32 wounded soldiers brought in within 1 month. The military says there are 14 in Douala. 34-year-old Masha Monte, who was part of the forces fighting separatists in the English-speaking southwest region, is a survivor. He says for the first time since the war started, he saw separatist fighters using modern war weapons when they were attacked at the Yumojok.
Ils ont progressé à pied puisque toute la zone était minée.
He says one of their vehicles was pulled down by a bomb planted by the separatists. He says as they struggled to evacuate him and his wounded colleagues to the nearest hospital, they detected many other landmines and could not continue, and some of his already exhausted and wounded colleagues died from excessive bleeding as they were not able to trek to the nearest hospital that was 10 kilometers away. Monte said although he is a soldier ready to defend Cameroon all the times, he thinks a negotiated deal could spare the lives of many, especially now that the fighters seem to be importing more war weapons. Cameroon's police head, Martin Bargangele, visited the wounded policemen and the families of those who died in battle. He says all survivors and victims will be taken care of and Cameroonians should be proud of people who died defending them.
La douleur est immense. C'est humain, c'est compréhensible.
He says, although the agony has been almost unbearable, Cameroonians should be proud they have heroes who agreed to serve their beloved country by defending it and its people from every aggression, even if it means paying the ultimate price. He says Cameroon will always remember them as people who died defending its territorial integrity and will also support their families. Mbargangele said the government will supply what it takes for the forces to crush the fighters. Security analyst Christian Dongo, consultant with the Peace Commission of the six member states Central Africa Economic and Monetary Commission, says the fact that wars have persisted in Central African countries for the past 12 years is an indication there is illegal trade and proliferation of arms that supply armed groups.
Les États n'ont pas encore mis en place les commissions nationales.
He says Cameroon and its neighbors, especially Nigeria, Chad, and the Central African Republic, need to put in place permanent structures to examine and control the proliferation of weapons in their countries. He says the Boko Haram crisis and the carnage in CAR are indications there are massive illegal movements of weapons across porous borders. He says the separatists in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon may be getting supplies from existing illegal suppliers. The crisis in the northwest and southwest regions of Cameroon, now 3 years old, escalated on October 1, 2017, when militant secessionist groups symbolically proclaimed independence of an English-speaking state called Ambazonia. The United Nations estimates at least 1,800 people have been killed and more than 530,000 displaced since fighting broke out. It says about 1.3 million people are in need of assistance. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In a bid to align the laws of the land with the constitution, Zimbabwe has been working on an education bill that seeks to make basic education free, among other things. Reporter Kudzai Zinawashi speaks with various stakeholders who unpack the missed opportunities and positives that come with the legislation.
Valentine Maponga is with Veritas, a local non-profit organization that puts works of parliament and laws of Zimbabwe into the public domain to be accessed by the majority of the population. He explains the good that comes with the new education bill.
It declares that every child has a right to school education without discrimination. Also talks to the right to state-funded education. The bill says that no pupil should be denied education on the ground either non-payment of fees or pregnancy, which is quite positive. The economic situation in the country is not at the very best, and most parents are really struggling.
Many public institutions are inaccessible to people with disabilities. Maponga adds that the bill compels schools to have infrastructure to provide that access. He says this unrestricted access to education to every child speaks to the right to education and information. But as good as the bill may be, it has its shortcomings.
The bill was not properly crafted. There are a lot of defects and omissions that we find in the bill. For example, they speak to the issues of basic education fund in the memorandum of the bill. But if you go through the bill, that issue of basic education fund disappears.
He adds that the bill defines state-funded basic education in two versions. The first one, education, ends at grade 7, yet in another version, it ends at form 4. Obed Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He says they would expect more from the bill.
We have been pushing that the government in that bill tries to define what a school is. If you look at the South African Education Act, for example, they set norms and standards of what a school is. But in our Zimbabwean context, there's no definition for a school. So you find people living under a tree, they are said to be at a school.
Masaraure says the definition would help substandard schools get resources from government to be upgraded into schools within the prescribed standards. Maponga and Masaraure agree that the bill should clearly ban political abuse of school premises or property by political parties. In the past, political rallies have been at times held at schools and school furniture used for those functions. For VOA, this is Kudza Izinawashe from Harare.
Zimbabweans in Botswana have told their government that they are not prepared to invest back home under the prevailing economic and political climate. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government has turned to Zimbabwe in the diaspora in a bid to find elusive investment as the country plunges deeper into an economic crisis. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Martha Ngwenya has the details.
The Zimbabwean government sent a high-powered delegation to the Botswana capital, Gaborone, for a weekend meeting with the sole aim to convince its citizens in the neighboring country to invest back home. Despite the senior government officials' glowing presentations about investment opportunities in areas such as mining, tourism, agriculture in their homeland, the Zimbabweans made it clear that they are not keen to pour money in an uncertain climate. Business person Paul Chitate, who runs insurance outlets in Botswana and South Africa, says he's tried to invest back home, but describes the efforts as a nightmare.
I'm sorry to say His Excellency came here and gave us expectations about how we can get capital into Zimbabwe. I tell you honestly, it's a nightmare to do business in Zimbabwe.
Another Zimbabwean, Tendai Gwarume, says there cannot be a conducive environment for investors when there's a thriving black market and cash shortages persist.
My question to RBZ is, what guarantee are they giving me as an investor because they failed to fight the black market? Because the guy who is selling the money in the street has got no expenses. What he needs is his car and his shoes to run away when the police comes.
Veterinary doctor Michael Kora Kurumire says there is still an ease over land distribution with the system centralized in the capital Harare, which alienates a certain section of the population.
This, for me, is an indication of a skewed, a sort of distorted access to resources or opportunities. This applies to things like not only land, mining rights, claims, water rights, and even finance.
The government officials, who included permanent secretaries in key ministries such as tourism and mining, promised to take back the concerns to President Mnangagwa. For VOA, this is Martin Ngwenya in Gaborone, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, thousands of men, women and children are forced to flee to escape violence and persecution. June 20th marks World Refugee Day. Global refugee awareness on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.